So I'd like to introduce you this afternoon to a lady who does not need any introduction, and we've given her the afternoon shift because she's going to keep you awake for the next half an hour because you've just had your lovely lunch. This is Mary Kelly, Equity Director at QUT, and she's going to give you her insights about the future and what we need to do for you. Thank you.
Centre for letting me present here. It's an issue that I think is very important, couldn't be more central stage than it is at the moment, and is enmeshed in this big national debate about higher ed and what we should do in a way that we've never seen before. So I think it's wonderful to have people in the room who are responsible for the social justice dimensions of their universities and in many cases responsible for the administration of scholarships. And as we'll come to at the end, I'm going to make the point that the design of scholarship schemes is actually a very important factor. You can ruin a pot of money by allocating it wrongly. So there are two parts to this presentation, because I was asked to look at the future. Well, firstly, I just want to look back a little bit on the history of scholarships. I want to take a student-centred view of how they currently make ends meet, and we had those two beautiful case studies this morning. I want to analyse aspects of the current bills, and when I say that, I mean the original HERA bill, the HERA amendment bill from December, and also the Social Security bills, which there are two proposals in a number of those. And then make some suggestions about how to stabilise and improve those policy settings. And then later on, I want to talk about what we collectively learnt when we were last in a similar position, which was 2004, when Nelson first invented from Blake Space the Commonwealth Learning Scholarships, some of which are still with us. We then collectively worked out how to administer those, and then later on other things happened, but we learned things in 2004, and we have learned things in our own institutions, not just about what works, but how to get the biggest bang for the buck and what's missing, how do these things all hang together or not. So that's sort of two big sections. One's public policy and these new emerging settings, and then the other is really designing, the scholarship design principles that we might want to talk about and also might need to move quite fast on if in fact these proposed schemes come into being. So looking back, well, you know all this, but it's worth remembering that before Whitlam abolished fees, there was a thing called Commonwealth Scholarships. And there have been things called Commonwealth Scholarships which are utterly different in character over the years. So we have to not use that label, but talk about the thing and its characteristics. So the Menzies ones had two purposes. They were tuition fee exemptions, because it was upfront fees, and they were cost of living supports. So they were Commonwealth scholarships that did two things, and in full flower, they were quite widely distributed. And they were not distributed on social justice criteria, they were distributed on the marks you got in high school, but it wasn't a very high bar. It was people who were quite smart could get a Commonwealth scholarship, and anyone who's 60 or over who went to uni before then was first in the family, was almost certainly on one of those, and you hear people talk about that. So that was Commonwealth scholarships. And then there was, of course, once the no upfront fees came in, then we had a change in the settings, and which went for decades, and then in 2004, after a long hiatus, Brendan Nelson reintroduced something called Commonwealth Learning Scholarships, and farm them out to universities to allocate to low-income students under strict guidelines. But the dollar amounts were modest. They were $2,000 and $4,000. There were two types to start with. And they were only for one purpose, education and living costs. There was no need to have tuition exemption costs because that was not an issue under the HECS settings at the time. By 2010, these Commonwealth Learning Scholarships were renamed as Startup and Relocation, and they were moved to Centrelink to administer. So for a number of years, universities gave them out under guidelines, and then they were moved to Centrelink and became an automatic top-up to those on means-tested youth allowance, off-study and app-study in some cases. So currently, the situation is thousands of low-income students, both urban and rural, currently receive these, what I call Commonwealth Scholarship, real ones, and that has become an integral part of how they make ends meet. It's an unstable policy setting, and at the time people were cynical about Brendan Nelson's motives and wondered if he just did that rather than reform income support, which had faded away and was inadequate to the task, and whether that was just an easier and cheaper way of doing that. So, you know, it was critiqued at the time, and of course it was Julia Gillard who reformed income support when she was Education Minister in 2009. And that opened the door to many more students getting youth allowance and off-study than ever before. So I always thought that because these start-up scholarships and so on were automatic top-ups to youth allowance, which was means-tested, that one day they would be folded to base and they'd just become part of the general payment structure. But that's not what's being proposed. So while this is all happening, many institutions also have what they tend to call equity or needs-based scholarships, which have been built up from a number of sources, originally essentially from institutional resources and philanthropic effort. And of course, institutional resources, when you trace back the dollars, are only ever student money or government money. So there's student money, government money, and philanthropy. And most institutional schemes were built on those resources. Some universities have used HEP-based funding since 2011 to bolster their institutional scholarships, and in some cases invent new schemes for low-income students. Although in the only report we have about how HEP was spent, the spend on scholarships from HEP was only about 11% of the total spend. It's not by no means the dominant feature in HEP funding. So we've got several legislative proposals which complicate this landscape, and they're in different bills. The first thing I want to do is try and see this through a student's eyes, and this is a typical way of putting income together if you're a low-income person and can't get support from your family because they are too poor. Basically, the maximum rate for youth allowance, and this is just a typical single student away from home and so on, is what you can see there, about 11,000. And then you get the startup scholarship, which is another two. If you're a relocating person, you might get a relocation scholarship and rent assistance. And if you add those up, you know, it's variable rates depending on what year of study and how much rent you're paying. It's all too hard to try and get a figure for that, since it's a range. But also, there's paid work. There's a reason our students work 15 hours a week. And that reason is basically because 1A is not enough to live on, even if you get it. And many of our students are not on the full rate of youth allowance. Even though those settings are the most generous they've ever been in 20 years, there's still lots of people that you wouldn't call wealthy who do not get the basic income support from Centrelink and are on partial rates. And you've heard that student say, I'd have $1.50. She didn't get 11,000, she would have got about 1,000 or something. So it's a long sliding scale to the point where you get zero. More generous than it's ever been before. But the reason our students work is really to make up to about the 25 or 26,000 you need to live independently. And I guess I wanted to pull that up because the dominant factors by dollar amount are, They're not three, and the whole focus is on three in our current debate. So, not just by dollar amount, but also by predictability and consistency. When Centrelink administers something by a national means test, everyone is treated the same. And every poor person, regardless of what institution they go to, and some of them are at school still, will be treated the same, every family. There is national consistency in that. If you move universities, you don't lose it. It's you, as the individual, being assessed as to your financial need. The institutional scholarships, by their very name, tell you that that's not necessarily the case. You might get one if you go to that institution, and it depends how they decide to give them out. So I think when I went to try and figure out what would our students lose if the startup was converted and the relocation were cut, I figured out that QUT students would lose collectively about $6 million a year. And then I thought, well, I wonder what collectively they're getting under youth allowance, and I did some very dodgy maths and came up with, I think it's about $20 million a year income from youth allowance and about $6 million from start-up and relocation. And then I thought, well, what are they getting from their work? So you did more dodgy maths, 15 hours a week, $18 an hour, 40 weeks a year, and you get a figure like that, 10 or 11,000. So what struck me is that whilst we're all focused on item three, it's not the main game. The main game is the work, paid work, and the income support from Centrelink, which just happens to have these things called Commonwealth scholarships now. So we need to see all of that when we have a discussion and not just one part of it. Otherwise, it's quite misleading. So the next thing I wanted to talk about is the bills. Now, these are the four dimensions that are covered, and I'm only allowed to talk about scholarships, and I will do my best. But it's not easy to talk about scholarships without mentioning those other dimensions, because the amendments that are now on the table and the bills entangle scholarships in every part of those dimensions. For example, it's proposed that the startup scholarship be a loan, not a grant. Well, if it's a loan and you take it, that's got an obvious effect on student debt, one of the two big things that have been talked about, price and debt. Scholarships and HEP are just small things, but collateral damage from those first two. So there is a connection with debt and there's a connection with income. The commercial interest rate, before it got amended away, was clearly, had implications about, well, will we need tuition fee scholarships again so that poor people can avoid terrible debt because it's going to be so hard to pay it back? Luckily, we don't have to worry about that again at the moment. The 1 in 5 proposal, and you'll notice I do not call it a Commonwealth scholarship scheme and never will. I call it the 1 in 5 proposal, where that $1 of every 5 of the university determined fee hikes is put aside for scholarships or outreach or learning support or other support measures. Has an obvious impact on course price because it amounts to 25% more than you needed to charge, and student debt. And in December, it was proposed that an unnamed amount of HEP funding be tagged for grants to universities for scholarships, for some universities, not all, and that's got obviously effects on the base grant of HEP. So I will try very much to just talk about scholarships, but the tentacles are now all entangled. So I'm going to go through three items and talk about whether they're good public policy or not. And I've got strong views, they're not shared views, but there you go. The idea of taking the startup scholarship, and let's just go back to that, which our students use now for cost of living, and whether price and debt change, the cost of living is going to be the same next year, and they're going to be, according to this proposal, $2,000 worse if they don't take out the loan. So it's going to be, the suggestion that it be converted from a grant to a loan isn't an invention of this government. It was the Labor Party who thought of that when they were chasing their elusive surplus, and they characterise it as being needed to get the money together to support the Gomsky reforms. That was a very bad moment in public policy, and this is still a terrible idea. And it's not just because our poor students will lose money, it's the precedent issue. So if that, what I consider now to be an integral part of the income support system, can be converted to a loan, then why not the relocation scholarship, which the Commission of Audit suggested happen, and why not youth allowance itself, as has happened in England, if you want to make a comparison. There is no logical impediment. Once you say whatever was a grant may be a loan, then there will be pressures on future governments to use that strategy to shift costs. So I think the precedent issue here is very scary. I think then there's two things happens. Either a student takes such a loan because they need the money to live on, in which case they'll have $6,000 of more debt than the wealthy people in their same course on exit, or they don't take the loan, and how will they make up the difference? They will work longer hours, because what other options have they got in that little table to do? So if you want to work out what $2,000 is in hours of work, it's a few hours a week. So we know that 15 hours a week is the risk, is the average, and it's risky. Anything above that detracts from study time and drives down success. We do not want to put our low-income students in a position where the only way they can make ends meet is to work even more hours in casual jobs. So I was kind of both surprised and disappointed that the sector didn't say hands off the startup scholarship. They didn't. There was largely a silence around this matter, and I thought, that's not very good. The ATN, which is the group I'm part of, made it a big strong issue when they did their submission to the Centre Standing Committee, and EFIA, the practitioner body, made it a big issue, but there has not been an outcry because people got consumed around the price of debt about this loss, which I think is a dangerous loss. I don't think most universities could even name how many of their students are on means-tested Centrelink benefits, and yet we know this. The last published data was in 2012, and in proportion terms, depending on your institution, it's somewhere between 7 and 17% of your students are on means-tested Centrelink benefits, and in headcount terms, that's somewhere between 600 and 5,500 students, all about to lose 2,000 or perhaps 3,000 if they lose their relocation scholarship or more. And so who's done the sums about how that could be institutionally made up? And which optimistic Vice Chancellor was thinking they could find, in our case, $6 million for this for the next year and so on? Because they were slated to go this year before deregulation came in. In the end, we didn't have to do that because those guidelines didn't get through. What has gone through, though, is something about relocation scholarships, which have been reduced in number by general agreement. People going from capital city to capital city no longer get it, but there were no grandfathering arrangements, so some of our existing low-income students just lost that, and that's already happened. So that's the only thing, I think, that's got through the Parliament at this stage. So I guess, and the total savings for government in changing the relocation and startup changes about $800 million. So, you know, it's not to be sniffed at. This was a cost-saving measure, I think, in essence. I think that we need to, if you take the lens back to Nelson and those Commonwealth Learning Scholarships, you can see what we've got left, and there's a handout on the table. I know it's old-fashioned, but I get a handout, and it's got a table, and it's got what people call scholarships, equity scholarships, and there's six sections. I'm going to come to that in a minute. The first three are really, let me just find it. The first three are really what Nelson did in 2004, the remnants thereof. So the closest in kind is the Indigenous scholarships, which are still given to universities to administer. They were not sent to Centrelink, and I have to say good, because I think universities are a more friendly administrative agent for that kind of scholarships than not. So they still exist, and under the old model, hideously detailed guidelines, government reporting, bidding process for how many you get, you don't find out until too late, you know, all of those things that I'm not complaining about. It's fantastic to have that money, but it is an administrative challenge, as it was in 2004, to work that way, where government decides the product value and the eligibility, and then you administer it locally. But anyway, they still exist. Two and three are the renamed Nelson Commonwealth Scholarships, gone off to Centrelink. Some of the relocation have gone and startups in danger. So I think elsewhere in the Social Services and Other Legislation Amendment Bill 2014, Budget Measures Number 4, and it's a wonder you haven't read it, it's a really good read, is another social security change that will affect our students, and that's a pensioner education supplement. Students who are on carers, pensions or disability pensions don't get youth allowance, they get those instead, but they can't get start-up. It was a flaw in how that was done at the time, that they don't get either start-up or relocation, but what they get is the pension or education supplement, and it's slated for removal. So again, the ATN put forward that that should not happen to our students, some of which are amongst the most needy. And one of the students, coincidentally this morning, is precisely one of those benefits that would attract the pension or education supplement. So you can't just look at the HERA bill, you've got to look at the social services bill. So there's two standing that we're interested in. One is this convert the start-up to a loan, that's in one bill, and the pensioner education supplement is in another bill. So the second change, proposed change in public policy I want to talk about is the 1 in 5 proposal. And I do think that the net effect of this will be to undermine and all but destroy this national scheme of targeted scholarships and replace it with an atomised, untargeted patchwork of what are called Commonwealth scholarships, but really will be institutional scholarships. They will be determined by the institution, the product name, the product value, the guidelines and so on, and how they're given out. And if you move institutions, you don't take it with you. That's an institutional scholarship. In this case, I think that there's many things you could say about this proposal, about what is wrong with it. I mean, it has some superficial attractiveness, but there's a lot of things not right about it. And one of them is the general principle of taxation and income support, that it's all of us through the taxation system that pay for youth allowance, and that is redistributed in the relocation and the accommodation cost scholarships. This is a way of singling out one group of citizens, in this case students, to pay for one of those benefits through higher course prices. I don't think that is right. I don't think that's how we would run the welfare system. It's not how we would run merit scholarships. It's a very odd proposal to think that just some people should pay for this redistribution to the poor, which is, you know, part of the welfare system. I don't think that is in principle correct. And of course it's accompanied by these other cuts, so there's a cost shifting effect as well. It adds to student course price, because in essence, if you've got to put aside $1 in every $5 of the money you need to run a course, you've got to add 25% to what you would otherwise charge, so that you can put it aside. So it does inflate the course price in some way. And I think, is it related to the price of the course? Not really. Scholarship for low-income people is an unrelated item. Is it an example of price gouging? I think it is. I've tried to argue, and I don't know if this is a good idea or not, that one way to modify this proposal would be to not make it compulsory. In a deregulated system, there would be nothing stopping a university who wanted to charge a certain amount and put some of that aside and do this work. And they could make that as a market decision. For some universities, such as my own, we've already built a very large scholarship scheme, we probably wouldn't do it. But we've got a philanthropic base and so on and so on. So why wouldn't this be a voluntary act by a university? Why is it compulsory? And I think that, I know why, but I think when you pose that question, you think about, well, is this the way that people want to build institutional scholarship programs or not? I think the allowable purposes of the money collected is far too broad. It is HEP Mark II and endangers HEP in the medium term, and in fact, it didn't. Poor old HEP didn't even make it till December because it instantly became redistributable money because money for similar purposes was going to be collected out in a different way. In a way, it also puts at risk, I think, SSAF and some of those other dedicated POCs. So I don't think it helps in that way. And its main flaw, and this has been much talked about, is the maldistribution that results. How big your course price is and how much you collect will determine how much you've got to administer to people in your institution, whether they're poorer than people down the road or not. So it is utterly the opposite of a Centrelink-administered, national, individualised means test. It is an institutional program that only benefits people in that institution. So whether we want that to become the main game is a public policy question. Now, I won't go on about that. No, I won't go on about that either. But I do think that when it first came in, I thought, oh well, and particularly when debt was on the table, I thought, well, this money will have to be used to exempt our poor students from paying the higher prices. So that means, you know, five students will pay it so the sixth doesn't have to. And I went down the path of, well, how many is that? It's 16.6% of that cohort, whatever. And would that be enough? Well, it depends how many you've got and so on. But what's become clear to me since is no one really envisaged this as being a mechanism by which some students wouldn't have to pay higher prices. What they're envisaging is everyone will pay the higher price and then it will be partially redistributed back to the poor. So you've got poor students funding their own scholarships through higher course prices. There's something just not right, I think, about that. Okay, and I guess the third element is what in that table is number six. This is the December surprise scholarship package, whereby, apart from the one in five, which had a lot of airplay, there was an amendment now on the table to tag, I guess, an amount, an unnamed amount of HEP funding, and make that available to some universities above a threshold also undefined, so that they can use it for scholarships which are alleged to be needs-based for low-income and or rural in ways that are not clear. That's a bit of a surprise. Those of us who envisage HEP as incentive funding, particularly for outreach, are not happy that some money will now no longer be available, even if we were to get a grant. So the threshold that says whether you get a HEPAP grant at all, it looks like it's going to be the same threshold as to whether you get this scholarships grant as well. So you'll either get both or neither. And it's not clear what that will do to the collaborative, partnership-based outreach stuff in particular that's grown up under HEP incentives in future years. I don't think it will, I don't think they can be sustained unless everyone is incentivised for the pre-tertiary domain. So I'm not allowed to go on about HEP thresholds, I promised I wouldn't. But this new one, which is about scholarships, is actually just going to take a slice off the top. Will it be very large, thus reducing the grants to those who get them? Or will it be very small? And if it's very small, will it make a difference by the time you give it out to 20 universities and so on? What will the guidelines be? Don't know yet. Will they be the same as the 1 in 5 guidelines? No, they'll be different. Neither, they're both in some kind of embryonic state somewhere. Will they be strict or light on? Don't know. The 1 in 5 are meant to be light touch, because after all, it's not their money. But this is Commonwealth money. I didn't know whether to call six Commonwealth or institutional. I really should have put it slash, because it's Commonwealth money. But there's every indication that institutions will determine the products, the product value and the distribution. So that sort of institutional as well, you can't take them with you when you move institutions. So they're a hybrid type of scholarship. So if you're in the administration of scholarships, we may well end up with three sets of guidelines to administer three sets of scholarships, which are really meant to be targeted at the same folks. So I've also suggested in amendments we've put up through the ATN that we need to, in the, this is just a minor point but an important one, the current bill doesn't actually say poor people. It says this money will be used for scholarships for students, for disadvantaged students. And elsewhere in the bill, disadvantaged students are defined as people who are members of each of the equity groups, the Old Martin groups, including women in non-traditional areas. And low SES students are defined as people from an SA1 postcode. So if you read it literally, you can only give these to people by postcode who come from low SES postcodes, and you could give them to wealthy people from the country, or wealthy NESB people, or wealthy women in non-traditional areas. So we've suggested a words in there, experiencing financial hardship, to make sure that this is not used I think that's an unintended consequence of the way that the bill was probably hastily put together, but at the moment, you don't even have to give these to poor people, just have to be members of the group. So, look, when it comes to public policy, I've always thought, oh no, I won't say that, but, well, yes, I will. Public policy doesn't obey the laws of physics. And the second law of thermodynamics says entropy will go to a maximum if you leave it alone. That's not how it works in public policy. If you make it unstable, illogical, things that don't nest together or contradict each other or undermine each other, in due course they will collapse and go back to an equilibrium and go back to something that's more logical and more stable. So I think what we've got now, when you look at those six nodes, is instability and illogicality in how we want to provide financial support to our low-income students, and it is inevitable. Even if it was brought in 2 or 3 years later, it would have to be reformed because it just is going to be so complicated and contradictory. So there's a heap of changes that need to be made in the bills as they stand. I do not think HEP funding should be tagged and diverted to scholarships. I know that solves a political problem about the mouth. That was in response to people's concern that the 1 in 5 proposal, the money would end up where the students weren't. And people said, well, can you pool the money and redistribute, and that became impossible. Well, can we have some more scholarship money then? Well, we haven't got any new money, so we'll use this old money. We'll redistribute some money we've already got. It was as simple as that. So it solves a political problem, but it certainly doesn't do HEP any favours. I do think we should oppose the conversion of start-up from scholarship to a grant. I don't care what happens in the other 5 boxes. That's part of income support now and should stay. And we have to, as I say, think about whether the 1 in 5 could be compulsory or excised and so on. I think if those changes were carried out, we would have something called the Commonwealth Scholarship Program, which was indeed Commonwealth, and we could continue to build our institutional schemes as well. Now, I don't just want to talk about the government here. This isn't an anti-government raid, because we need to examine quite closely our own behaviours in how we've dealt with institutional equity scholarships over the years, and it's not all a pretty picture. Part of it has been about the public policy settings, and part of it has been about different forces in our university. So I'm going to go back, I want to stop talking about public policy now. I've made the point that I think it's messy and unstable and it won't last and it's not very good for students, it's too untargeted. But I now want to talk about, well, if these new piles of money come in, what's it going to look like in how they're distributed? How are they going to be given out? And we need to remember, I think, what happened in 2004, and there are some people here who were the administrators of those CLS at the time, and we were all very excited at the start. There were 2 types of scholarships and Baroque guidelines, but they had been developed through a consultative all-in mechanism, and we had all had a say and got things in there that we wanted, because we already all had institutional schemes. It wasn't a greenfield site. So these scholarships had to be nested and made to work with whatever already existed. So I think the things we struggled with and the things we learned from are, I think, those four that are up on the screen. And the first is, how do you tell who needs the scholarship? How do you tell if people are low income or not? Well, nobody uses postcode. I mean, you just don't even have to think about that. And really, there's only two ways to do it, and these were actually written into the guidelines at the time. One way is to rely on Centrelink's assessment of people and say, well, if Centrelink says you pass their means test, I know something about you. I know you're in the low income zone, so I will use that as my group that I'm going to give these new scholarships to. Except that we all know there's poverty outside of those Centrelink cutoffs, and there certainly was then. This is before the reforms. So some other of us wanted to do our own assessment at the university, and we were allowed by those guidelines to do so. We could determine who was the neediest by mechanisms that we invented ourselves. And I think at least half a dozen universities came up with schemes that looked at both income and expenditure and life circumstances in multifactorial weighted analysis, blah, 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 that could figure out who needed the scholarships the most. One of the issues there, and we face it now, is that poverty is a continuum. There's no such thing as a threshold of poverty. People are either really, really poor, or really poor, or a bit poor, or, you know what I mean? It is a sliding scale. So there's no such thing as a cutoff below which you don't have to think about those people. You have to, in fact, find a way to work out relative need in an applicant pool which is always bigger than the number of products you've got to give out, whether it's your institutional scholarships, Commonwealth ones, or even youth allowance. That's why they have those means tests. You can't satisfy all needs, so how do you then measure and fairly put in a queue those who have got some claim on disadvantage and poverty? And all of us have found a way to do that and to work out how we can compare two people with utterly two different life stories, like the two we had this morning. They are the two contenders for the last scholarship you've got to give out. You better have a good process for working out who's going to get it, and a process that doesn't rely on sentimentality or random opinions of the selection panel, but relies on criterion-referenced assessment, comparable judgments, and properly constructed face validity of the instruments you're using, with weighted points that make sense. On the next one, in 2004, this is probably the thing we talked about the most. Should we count people's marks, either their GPA, if they were a continuing student, or their ATAR, if there was they were a commencing student? Many of us already had schemes where we didn't look at it at all. And the view was, if the student's good enough to get into the institution, they're good enough to be considered. And whoever's the neediest should get the money. But this brings into focus, I think, the philosophy of how you think about equity scholarships and how distinctly different it is from a merit scholarship. A merit scholarship, it is by definition a reward for being clever. You've got good marks, therefore you get this pot of money. An equity scholarship is no such thing. It is a pot of money, it looks the same. You're giving someone a pot of money, but it is based on you need this money because you don't have any money. And if you don't have any money, you might drop out or you might not come and so on. So we should call them needs-based scholarships. And people get tangled up with whether you should count marks or not. Shouldn't we just give it to the bright poor because they're a better risk? Shouldn't we, you know? And so I'm sure you've had those conversations inside your institution, and each of us has settled them in different ways. I've got a very kind of rigid view about it, which is if these are needs-based scholarships, then needs should drive who gets them. The primary and hopefully sole driver of who gets those scholarships. But I'm sure that will come up again. And in 2004, merit was put in the guidelines, but it was left to institutions about how you used it. And some of us used it barely at all, or not, and some used it to sort out people who are on Centrelink benefits and to give out the Commonwealth scholarships by that means. It's a dilemma we face every day in this zone. And I think the last one, I mean, you know you've been in the sector too long when you take an interest in business processes, but really, I've never done anything so complicated as scholarship administration. And we do lots of complicated things in my department. But if you have something that covers commencing and continuing, something that relies on extracting data from the student system, from the TAC, if you do Commonwealth, if you've got to pay people, so you're connected to the finance system, you've got to do government reporting, so you're connected to HEAMS, you've got to make it nest with other scholarships, you've got to have rules for concurrent holding, blah, 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 blah. It is quite tricky, and universities were not well equipped to do this when it first happened, and we scrambled to get business processes in place, and some of them are still a bit clunky. So if we're going to have three schemes with three different sets of guidelines and so on, we will face those same issues. And the only way you can make this fair and easy for students is to have exceptionally good business processes and very good connectivity with the system, so they don't have to fill out 100 forms telling you things you're already supposed to know, and you can extract data rather than get them to provide it and so on. You know the drum, but it is not without its complications in a purely administrative sense, and to get that right makes it easier for students, and that's a really important part of what we learned, I think, in 2004. Okay, let's move on a little bit then. I just want to talk a little bit about QUT scheme, not because it's the one I know the best and because I've been on that journey about what we learnt in the doing of it. And I know everybody's got schemes and, you know, we've all shared these before and there's good practice everywhere, but I do just want to focus on this. We started our scheme before the CLS, and I argued in the CLS that we should be able to do our own assessment because that's what we were already doing, and I didn't want to have to only use Centrelink as a cut-off, and we got that. So since that time, all needs-based scholarships are in one process, one form, and 2,200 products of various different sorts. We took a view that we would make it, we'd have no eligibility requirements, basically. If you're enrolled, you can apply. International, domestic, part-time, full-time, postgrads, PhDs, anybody can apply, and if they're needy, they'll get some money. And we took the view that these were retention devices, and the research has proven us correct on this matter, and that we wanted not just to find the cash pool, but the time pool, because we knew that's what makes you drop out. If you've got a complicated life and no money, you're in a worse position than someone with a simple life and no money, and vice versa. So the factors we consider are every factor you would expect. We don't look at technical membership of equity groups, but we ask about income. So we call it like Centrelink Plus. So it's income, expenditure, and this was based on the Saunders research out of UNSW about what financial deprivation looks like in the holistic lived life, and it isn't about your cash flow. It's about what you can afford on a daily basis and what you're missing out on, what deprivation to experience. So we get students to give us, it's all evidence-based, they have to give us their credit card statements and their bank card statements, what they've been spending their money on for the last 6 months, and we look at it and we see if deprivation is evident in their lived life. And we also look at life circumstances. Anything that complicates your life and eats into your time or prevents you from doing paid work, we count it. So if you're a carer for children, care for someone with disabilities, got a disability yourself, socially isolated because you come from a long way away, trauma and whatever in your background, refugees and so on. So we worked out early on what we like to think is a holistic, whole of person assessment, weighted the points, we've argued about the weightings and tweaked them for, done this for 10 years now, we give out about 5 million a year and have about 5,000 applicants each year. So it works for us, and it's not dependent on other guidelines, and we basically, I think, have tried to make it easy for students. And when they say, oh, should I apply, am I eligible? We say, well, unless you're hideously wealthy, you should give it a shot. That's it. And then we tell them, once we've done all of these points, people get a total point score, they're put in a queue based on their total points, that's the neediness queue, and we give out the products in order of value so that the poorest people get the best stuff until we run out of stuff, and that's the cut-off. It's a bit like ATAR's in some ways. So that's how we've arranged the world to solve those complex problems of who shall I give it to when you've got this competition. And we've learned from that that it works. We've done the data analysis on attrition and surveyed the students for 10 years. The message is the same. The attrition rates drop. For the first few years, the attrition rates of these very poor low SES people were better than that of all other students. We couldn't believe our eyes. That's attenuated over time. It's there now. They've closed the gap, but they're not better. They're just under. But when we survey students, this is what they say. There's a practical effect from the scholarship. Clearly, they use the money on educational or living costs. 50% of them reduce their paid work hours using the money they get from the scholarship. They buy time with it. So the net effect of getting the scholarship is more time, less stress. They can devote that to study, and that makes them complete. So they are a retention device. Surprisingly, they also talked about psychological effect, and this has been the same for the last 9 years as well, which is they felt a sense of belonging to the institution. They felt motivated by being chosen and wanting to prove that they were worth it. So there was this quite strong psychological effect around what we call sense of belonging in the first experience lexicon, as well as this practical effect, the net result of which is more time and attention to study and lower dropout. And that is what scholarships are for. We also ask our students, because we offer early and pay early. It's a high trust scheme. So we pay before census day. And there's a risk around that. Some people leave and never see the money again, but not many. There's a lot more leave if you wait and wait and wait until week three. They're already gone by then because they didn't have any money to buy books and stuff. So we pay early and we don't do heavy tracking, and we tell people before Christmas, as many of you do. And so we ask people, did knowing you were going to get the scholarship, because some people know in advance, make you enrol here? I forget what the words are. And most of them say, oh, it helped me persist with my enrolment. But it wasn't the trigger that made aspiration come from nowhere. So it helps people persist with their what we would see as a recruitment decision. But a lot of them say, we give this as an option in the questionnaire, I was going to come anyway. And 50% of them tick that. So we have concluded long ago that scholarships are not a major recruitment device, and you probably shouldn't try and use them as one, but they are a major retention device because they're the icing on the cake, and the cake is income support and paid work. So I guess in conclusion, I'll give them the nod. I think the next important steps are we should bring our knowledge to bear in this public policy discussion to see if we can get a tidier, more student-focused landscape out of it. But simultaneously, we had better work with the department on these emerging guidelines, and I'm very pleased that the National Centre is in this space and thinking about those issues, because there's clearly not going to be an all-in consultative process this time, and so we can feed our views about what those guidelines should say or not say through the National Centre if we needed to, and that's really important. So that's all for the moment. Thanks.